The next topic is identity theft. In Roberts, on page 244, the Court of Appeals determined that New York's identity theft statute is violated by the use of personal identifying information, like a credit card number, without more. The first department case, which was reversed by the Court of Appeals, had held the mere use of personal identifying information is insufficient, and the people must establish a defendant both used the victim's personal identifying information and assumed the victim's identity. The first department concluded the proof had established that defendant used the personal identifying information of the victim, but had not assumed her identity. The defendant in that first department case had assumed the identity of a fictitious person. The fourth department case, which was also reviewed by the Court of Appeals, which was affirmed, concluded defendant's use of the victim's name and bank account number established she assumed his identity within the meaning of the statute, and the phrase assumes the identity of another person is not a discrete element of the identity theft statute. So again, Roberts has indicated that it's enough to demonstrate the use of another person's identifying information to constitute a violation of the identity theft statute. Next topic, immigration. In the Saglin case on page 246, the Second Department held Supreme Court did not have the power to suppress defendant's pre-sentence report that was being used in immigration proceedings. The court wrote, "Here, since the Department of Homeland Security did not obtain the pre-sentence report in the course of any disclosure process under the CPLR, there is no basis for the issuance of a protective order pursuant to the CPLR. Moreover, since control over immigration and naturalization is entrusted exclusively to the federal government, and the state has no power to interfere, the Supreme Court lacked the power to suppress the pre-sentence report in the immigration proceedings." In Suazo, on page 246, the Court of Appeals held that even though defendant was not entitled to a jury trial for a B misdemeanor, the fact that deportation was a potential penalty entitled defendant to a jury trial pursuant to the Sixth Amendment. The next topic is innocent possession of a weapon. In Graham, on page 247, the court held that the jury should have been instructed on the innocent possession of a weapon defense. There was evidence that the defendant wrestled the gun away from a person who was threatening him with it and then took it home. In Bonilla, on page 247, the court held the jury should have been instructed on the innocent possession of a weapon defense. There was evidence the defendant was struck with the gun, took it away, walked away, and then was attacked from behind and shot the two attackers. In Saki L., on page 248, the court held the jury should have been instructed on the lawful temporary possession of a weapon. There was evidence the defendant was attacked from behind and grabbed a knife from the attacker and swung at the attacker in self-defense. Next topic is kidnapping. In Williams, on page 249, the court affirmed the kidnapping conviction. The kidnapping conviction was premised upon the restraint of the victim with duct tape. The dissent argued the tape was not a dangerous instrument, and under the facts, kidnapping merged with the robbery. The court wrote, "The duct tape used by the defendant constituted a dangerous instrument. Any instrument, article, or substance, no matter how innocuous it may appear to be when used for its legitimate purpose, becomes a dangerous instrument when it is used in a manner which renders it readily capable of causing serious physical injury. The object itself need not be inherently dangerous. It is the temporary use rather than the inherent vice of the object which brings it within the purview of the statute." Next topic, opioids, pill mills. In Stan Hui, that's Xuihui, on page 251, the court determined defendant, a doctor accused of operation of a pill mill for persons addicted to opioids and Xanax, was properly convicted of manslaughter in the overdose deaths of two persons to whom he supplied drugs. Next, there was a Court of Appeals case on the violation of the law by possessing a police scanner, and it turned on the meaning of the word equipped. It's the Andujar case on page 252. The Court of Appeals determined defendant was properly convicted of equipping his tow truck with a police scanner without a permit. The scanner was not attached to the vehicle. It was in the defendant's pocket. And the court found that the word equipped would encompass that factual situation. Possession of a forged instrument. In Watts on page 253, the Court of Appeals held that counterfeit concert tickets fall within the ambit of the statute prohibiting possession of a forged instrument. Possession of a controlled substance. In Whitehead on page 254, the Court of Appeals noted that possession of cocaine can be proven without submitting the cocaine itself as evidence. The court wrote, although the people did not recover or introduce any of the cocaine that defendant was charged with possessing, direct evidence in the form of contraband or other physical evidence is not the only adequate proof. The people presented sufficient evidence in the form of, among other things, defendant's intercepted phone calls replete with drug-related conversations, visual surveillance, and the testimony of cooperating witnesses. Next topic is robbery. In Smith on page 259, the Court of Appeals determined the evidence was sufficient to support the element of robbery first degree, which requires the display of what appears to be a firearm. The defendant threatened to shoot the teller, and at some point in time, one of his hands was under his hoodie. The defendant was quickly apprehended, and no firearm was found. In Williams, on page 259, the court affirmed defendant's robbery and kidnapping convictions. The robbery first-degree conviction was premised upon the use of duct tape over the victim's mouth and around the victim's wrists as constituting a dangerous instrument capable of inflicting serious injury. In Allende, on page 260, the First Department, reversing the robbery first conviction over a partial dissent, determined that there was no evidence the victim saw a firearm. The court wrote, the evidence did not establish the element of display of what appeared to be a firearm. The robbery was accomplished by assaulting the victim and taking his wallet. Although an eyewitness saw the display of what appeared to be a firearm, there was no evidence that the victim ever saw it. In Burkett on page 260, the First Department determined the introduction of a handgun alleged to be the same type used in the crime and recovered 3 months after the crime was not error. This case was discussed above in the burglary discussion. I'll just again read the quotation from the court. The court providently exercised its discretion in admitting a black 9mm pistol, the same type of weapon that, according to other evidence, was used in the crime. The pistol was recovered pursuant to a search warrant from defendant's girlfriend's apartment 3 months after the commission of the crime, and the evidence showed that defendant resided in that apartment. This evidence was relevant to show that defendant had access to that type of weapon, and it thus tended to establish his involvement in the charged crimes. The jury could have drawn a reasonable inference that the weapon was in defendant's possession at the time of the crime, and the availability of other inferences went to the weight rather than admissibility. Furthermore, the probative value of this evidence, which the court carefully limited, outweighed any prejudicial effect. Next topic is scientific material, the unlawful use of scientific material. In the Alenyakov case, on page 262, the Court of Appeals determined the evidence was sufficient to convict the defendant of violating Penal Law 165.07, which is unlawful use of secret scientific material. Just before leaving the employ of Goldman Sachs to begin work at another company, the defendant had copied to a German server source code used by Goldman Sachs for high-frequency trading. There was no evidence anyone other than the defendant had access to the uploaded source code. The major issues were whether the source code had a physical form or was appropriated within the meaning of the statute. The court wrote, "We conclude that there is legally sufficient evidence that defendant created a tangible copy of the source code on the German server in violation of Penal Law Section 165.07. Appropriation does not imply depriving another of property. In fact, larceny in general is defined as involving either intent to appropriate or intent to deprive, with the clear implication that the two terms refer to separate concepts. Defendant may have intended to appropriate the source code without intending to deprive Goldman of all possession or use." Next topic is terrorism. In the Richardson case, on page 265, the Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction under New York's terrorism statute, applying a weight of the evidence review, determined that although the defendant threatened to kill a judge in letters to his wife, there was no proof the threat was made to influence or affect the policy or conduct of a unit of government. In Hulson, on pages 265 and 266, the Second Department determined defendant's statement to a teacher that on the day he was fired from his school custodian job, he would, quote, "Columbine this shit," end quote. That statement was not legally sufficient evidence of a terrorist threat within the meaning of the penal law. The indictment was properly dismissed upon reading the grand jury minutes. That ends the section that deals with evidence issues that relate directly to specific offenses. And now we're moving on to section 3, hearsay. First topic is background information. The fact that evidence provides background information is not a ground for admitting hearsay. In Grierson on page 267, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined hearsay statements from two witnesses named Jones and Grierson about the presence of a gun in the defendant's apartment were not admissible as background information to explain why the police searched the apartment. The court wrote, "Although general and cursory testimony by one of the officers would have sufficed to explain why they began the search for a weapon, county court permitted all four officers to testify in detail that Jones and Grierson stated that defendant had a gun and also allowed the people to elicit further information from two of the officers as to Jones's and Grierson's description of the gun. In light of the repetitive and detailed nature of the testimony, we find that it exceeded the permissible scope of explanatory background information." Next topic is the business record exception to the hearsay rule. In Jones, on page 269, the court, reversing defendant's conviction for possession of a forged instrument, it was a counterfeit check, determined two categories of hearsay evidence were improperly admitted without foundation. The court wrote, The court erred in admitting in evidence a printout of electronic data that was displayed on a computer screen after defendant presented a check, the allegedly forged instrument, to a bank teller. The people failed to establish that the printout falls within the business records exception to the hearsay rule, because they presented no evidence that the data displayed on the computer screen, resulting in the printout, was entered in the regular course of business. The court improperly admitted an investigator's testimony about the results of a search he ran in a credit bureau's commercial database for email addresses and a telephone number contained in a cover letter that enclosed the counterfeit check defendant tried to cash. The people failed to establish the requisite foundation for this testimony, inasmuch as the investigator did not testify that he is familiar with the practices of the company that produced the records at issue and that he generally relies upon such records. In Bell, on pages 268 and 269, the court determined the defendant's attempted murder conviction survived a weight of the evidence analysis, but the admission of documentary evidence was error which required reversal. The victim, Russo, had been shot in the head and could not remember who shot him. Before the grand jury, Russo testified that both the defendant, his name is Bell, and a man named Diaz were in the apartment at the time of the shooting. At trial, Russo testified Diaz was not in the apartment. A detective testified Diaz had been interviewed in Florida and provided timesheets on his employer's corporate letterhead indicating he was in Florida at the time of the shooting. Those timesheets were erroneously admitted in evidence without meeting the criteria for the business records exception to the hearsay rule. The court wrote, "We find that the court committed reversible error in admitting Diaz's timesheets into evidence. The business records of Diaz's employer were admitted without a proper foundation, and the court failed to clearly instruct the jury that the timesheets could not be considered for the truth of their content. The jury was not told that the timesheets could not be relied upon to conclude that Diaz was not in the apartment at the time of the shootings. The business records exception to the hearsay rule is codified in CPLR 4518A, and it also applies in criminal cases. For a business record to be admissible, it must be made in the regular course of business. It must be the regular course of business to make the record, and the record must have been made at the time of the act, transaction, occurrence, or event, or within a reasonable time thereafter, assuring that the recollection is fairly accurate and the entries routinely made. Business records are customarily offered through a foundation witness, such as the custodian of the records or an employee who is familiar with the record-keeping procedures of the record maker. There was a substantial disputed issue about whether Diaz was the additional person in the apartment, whom a co-defendant identified as the shooter. This conclusion was also supported by Russo's grand jury testimony, even though Russo later repudiated it. The timesheets established an alibi for Diaz that he was in Florida on October 25, 2007. Bell's defense was that he did not shoot Russo and someone else in the apartment did the shooting. Allowing the timesheets into evidence was not harmless error because there was a significant probability that the jury would have acquitted the defendant had it not been for the error. Next, there's one case on conspiracy that we've already discussed in the gang section. In Reyes, on page 270, the Court of Appeals held that the defendant gang member's presence at a meeting was not enough to demonstrate he joined a conspiracy to attack the victim. The court explained, the law does not contain a presumption of agreement based on sheer presence at a meeting at which a conspiracy is discussed, and we share the view of the federal courts that mere knowledge of the existence and goals of a conspiracy does not itself make one a co-conspirator. The next subtopic is co-conspirator statements. In Flanagan, on pages 270 and 271, the Court of Appeals held that co-conspirator statements made before defendant joined and after defendant's active involvement are admissible against the defendant unless the defendant has unequivocally communicated withdrawal from the conspiracy. Next topic is Crawford, testimonial hearsay, the right to confrontation. In Hao Lin, on page 272, the Court of Appeals determined the testimony of an officer, his name was Marcato, who was present throughout the DWI breathalyzer test process, administered by another officer, Harriman, did not violate the confrontation clause. Harriman had retired and moved out of state by the time of defendant's trial. The court wrote, inasmuch as Mercado testified as to his own observations, not as a surrogate for Harriman, there was no confrontation clause violation. Any alleged irregularities concerning the testing procedure would relate to the weight of Mercado's testimony, not its admissibility. In Metellus, on page 273, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined that the DNA evidence introduced by a witness who did not participate in the testing procedures violated defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him. The court wrote, the DNA profiles and reports produced from the testing of evidence recovered from the decedent's home, including defendant's clothing, are testimonial because such profiles and reports were generated in aid of a police investigation of a particular defendant charged by an accusatory instrument and created for the purpose of substantively proving the guilt of that defendant, and because all of the documents in the file of the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner refer to the defendant by name and label him a suspect. The admission of such evidence violated the defendant's confrontation right because it was admitted upon the testimony of an analyst who did not perform, witness, or supervise the generation of defendant's DNA profile or perform an independent analysis on the raw data. In Rodriguez, on page 274, the court determined a report on the DNA evidence which connected the defendant to the burglary did not violate the confrontation clause and was properly admitted. The majority argued that the report contained only raw data that was not part of a law enforcement effort aimed at the defendant because the sources of the DNA which were analyzed were not known to the technicians conducting the procedures. Therefore, the raw data was not testimonial evidence which would violate the confrontation clause. The criminologist, his name is Huyck, H-U-Y-C-K, who testified, came to conclusions about the sources of the tested DNA by comparing the non-testimonial raw data. The report generated by the criminologist, therefore, was admissible because she testified and was cross-examined. The dissenters argued that someone involved in collecting the raw data should have testified and been cross-examined about the testing procedures. Upon her own examination of the machine-generated graphs and raw data in this case, Huyck concluded that the two DNA profiles were a match. Her conclusion, based upon her own separate, independent, and unbiased analysis of the raw data, was reflected in the laboratory report bearing her name as analyst as well as in her own testimony at trial. Huyck did not base her testimony solely on the reports of the non-testifying analysts, which were then admitted into evidence for their truth. In Vargas, on pages 274 and 275, the court reversed defendant's conviction because a witness, Lopez, was allowed to testify he changed his testimony because he was threatened. Lopez's grand jury testimony was read into evidence, and then Lopez testified in accordance with the grand jury testimony. The second department held that there was insufficient evidence the defendant was behind the threats to Lopez. The court wrote, Here, the people failed to establish by clear and convincing evidence that Lopez had been made unavailable due to threats made at the initiative or acquiescence of the defendant. Accordingly, the Supreme Court violated the defendant's right to confrontation by allowing Lopez's grand jury testimony into evidence. In Tsintzelis, that's T-S-I-N-T-Z-E-L-I-S, on page 275, the court, although finding the error harmless, determined the introduction of DNA evidence without testimony by the analysts violated the Confrontation Clause. The court wrote, "The defendant's rights under the Confrontation Clause were violated when the Supreme Court admitted into evidence lab reports from a non-testifying DNA analyst which directly linked the defendant to the crime. Confrontation Clause violations are subject to a constitutional harmless error analysis. Constitutional error requires reversal unless the error's impact was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. This determination is based on a review of the entire record. In order for the error to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidence of defendant's guilt must be overwhelming, and there must be no reasonable possibility that the error might have contributed to the defendant's conviction. Here, apart from the erroneously admitted evidence, the evidence of defendant's guilt was overwhelming." In Austin, on page 275, the Court of Appeals determined the hearsay testimony by a criminalist about DNA test results violated defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him. A new trial was ordered. The criminalist had no firsthand knowledge of any of the DNA testing. The court wrote, "In order to satisfy the Confrontation Clause, defendant was entitled to cross-examine the analyst who either performed, witnessed, or supervised the generation of the critical numerical DNA profile, or who used his or her independent analysis on the raw data to arrive at his or her own conclusions. As we recently held, it is the generated numerical identifiers and the calling of the alleles at the final stage of the DNA typing that effectively accuses defendant of his role in the crime charged. The trial transcript plainly establishes that the criminalist had no such role here. Although the criminalist may have had some level of involvement in the office's handling of some of the 2009 crime scene swabs, he had no role whatsoever in the testing of defendant's post-accusatory buccal swab. His testimony was, therefore, merely a conduit for the conclusions of others." In Tavares, on page 276, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined in the interest of justice, the defendant was deprived of his right to confront a witness against him. A witness to the stabbing, Torres, could not be located and did not testify at the trial. Before it was clear Torres would not testify, two officers had already testified to facts that made it obvious Torres had identified the defendant as the perpetrator. The court wrote, "Although neither side can be faulted for the introduction of the arresting officer's testimony at a time when everyone believed in good faith that Torres would testify, once it became clear that Torres would not be produced as a witness, the arresting officer's testimonial hearsay regarding the information conveyed to them by Torres violated the defendant's constitutional right to confront the witnesses against him." In Stoeckling, on page 277, the Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction for aggravated unlicensed operation of a motor vehicle, determined that the testimony of a supervisor from the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles alleging that notice of the revocation of defendant's license was mailed to defendant violated defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him because the testimony was not based upon firsthand knowledge. The court wrote, "The DMV supervisor's testimony was improperly allowed to establish an essential element of the crime. The court, in permitting this testimony, failed to ensure that the defendant's Sixth Amendment right of confrontation was protected." In Jones, on page 278, the Second Department, reversing defendant's gang-related convictions, determined that the two police officers, Georg and Brachero, certified as experts in gang culture, served as conduits for inadmissible testimonial hearsay and acted as summation witnesses, usurping the jury's role of interpreting the evidence. We've already looked at this case under the gang, in the gang discussion. The court wrote, as a threshold matter, we note that Crawford does not bar the use of testimonial statements for purposes other than establishing the truth of the matter asserted. Thus, it is permissible for an expert witness to form an opinion by applying his or her expertise to otherwise inadmissible evidence because, in that limited instance, the evidence is not being presented for the truth of the matter asserted. Here, information derived from the debriefing of the arrested gang members constitutes testimonial statements within the meaning of Crawford. The more difficult question presented is whether the substance of such statements was impermissibly conveyed to the jury by Georg and or Bracero in the guise of expert testimony. We find that it was. In Torres, on page 278, the Second Department held that the anonymous 911 call was properly admitted into evidence in part because the call was non-testimonial. The recording was, the court wrote, the recording was admissible under the present sense impression exception to the hearsay rule. Moreover, the admission of the recording did not violate the defendant's right of confrontation. Since the primary purpose of the statements by the unidentified caller was to obtain an emergency response to a burglary in process, the statements were not testimonial in nature. Next, declaration against penal interest. In McFarland, on page 279, the court determined defendant's motion to vacate his conviction based upon newly discovered evidence of third-party culpability should have been granted. The statement at issue was admissible as a declaration against penal interest. The court wrote, the third party appeared at the hearing and exercised his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Thus, the court properly determined that he is unavailable to testify. Defendant called to the stand to testify the person to whom the third party allegedly made the admission. That witness testified that the third party told him in 2003 at the Monroe County Jail that it was he who shot the victim and that he implicated defendant because he did what he had to do to avoid serious jail time. Defendant provided sufficient competent evidence at the 440-10 hearing to establish the possibility of trustworthiness of the third party's statement to satisfy the requirement that the statement was a declaration against penal interest. Next topic is excited utterances. In Cummings, on page 282, the Court of Appeals, reversing defendant's conviction, determined that a statement heard in the background of a 911 call should not have been admitted as an excited utterance. The statement ostensibly identified the defendant as the man who had just shot three people. Other than the defendant's fingerprint found on the van the shooter got into, there was no evidence identifying the defendant as the shooter. Two trial judges had ruled the 911 statement inadmissible before a third trial judge allowed it to come in. The Court of Appeals held that the law of the case doctrine did not prohibit the third judge from ruling on the admissibility of the statement, but the statement was inadmissible because there was no evidence that the declarant observed the shooting. The court wrote, it must be inferable that the declarant had an opportunity to observe personally the event described in the spontaneous declaration. Direct observation by the person making the excited utterance ensures that the declarant is in fact reacting to and asserting the circumstances of the event causing the excitement. In Cassiano, on pages 282 and 283, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined a 911 call made by a non-testifying witness should not have been admitted as present sense impression or an excited utterance. The court wrote, the 911 call did not qualify as a present sense impression because the element of contemporaneity was not satisfied, and the people failed to demonstrate that the delay between the conclusion of the event and the beginning of the call was not sufficient to destroy the indicia of reliability upon which the present sense impression exception rests. The call also did not qualify as an excited utterance because the tenor of the call did not reflect that the caller was so excited or stressed by the incident that her ability to reflect thereon was stilled. In Chin, on page 283, the court determined a 911 call and a prior consistent statement were properly admitted as excited utterances. The Supreme Court properly admitted the testimony of the police officer and the victim's niece concerning the statements of the victim's son at the scene identifying the defendant as the shooter under the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule, and that testimony did not constitute improper bolstering. Next topic is prompt outcry. In Vaux, on page 290, the Fourth Department, reversing defendant's conviction, determined two evidentiary errors deprived defendant of a fair trial. Defendant was precluded from presenting evidence of a witness's motive to lie, and the evidence of prompt outcry should not have included the identity of the assailant. The court wrote, defendant correctly contends that the court erred in permitting the people to present prompt outcry testimony that exceeded the proper scope of such testimony. Although evidence that a victim of sexual assault promptly complained about the incident is admissible to corroborate the allegation that an assault took place, such evidence is limited to only the fact of the complaint, not its accompanying details, including the identity of the assailant. We thus conclude that the court erred in permitting two of the three prompt outcry witnesses to testify concerning the identity of the alleged assailant. Next topic is state of mind. We've already covered this case. It's the Hall case. It appears again on page 291. The court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined the jury should have been allowed to hear and see the videotape statements made by the detective to the defendant prior to the Miranda warnings and defendant's confession to the possession of drugs found in her house. Defendant's son had also been arrested, and the detective told defendant her son was involved in a shooting and was going to prison. Defendant argued at trial that she falsely confessed to the possession of the drugs in an effort to protect her son. Under defendant's theory of the case, the statements made by the detective during the pre-Miranda portion of the recording not only went to the voluntariness of her confession, but also established why she confessed falsely. Accordingly, county court's evidentiary rulings here excluded evidence directly relevant to a central issue in this case, defendant's state of mind at the time that she confessed to possessing the drugs. The next topic is witness unavailability, which is procured by the defendant. In Thomas, on page 293, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined the videotaped statement of an unsworn witness was properly admitted based upon proof the witness was unavailable due to the defendant's intentional misconduct. In Middleton, on page 292, the court reversed defendant's conviction and ordered a new trial because the people did not demonstrate that a witness's refusal to testify was the result of defendant's threats. Although the people presented evidence that the witness was afraid to testify, they failed to meet their heavy burden of showing that her fear was caused by a threat made by the defendant. In Vargas, on page 293, The court reversed defendant's conviction because a witness, Lopez, was allowed to testify. He changed his testimony because he was threatened. Lopez's grand jury testimony was read into evidence, and then Lopez testified in accordance with the grand jury testimony. The second department held that there was insufficient evidence the defendant was behind the threats to Lopez. Oh, the fourth code word for this 2019 Criminal Evidence Update CLE is deny. Again, the fourth code word to put on your form for this 2019 Criminal Evidence Update is deny. So we're moving now to the final section of the CLE, section 4 on searches. The first topic is a search incident to arrest. In Simmons on page 295, the court determined the seizure of a knife from the defendant was not the result of a valid search incident to arrest. The court wrote, although the record supports a finding that the officer had probable cause to arrest defendant for assault based on reliable information from the assault victim, the people failed to meet their burden of demonstrating that the officer intended to arrest the defendant for the assault at the time he recovered the knife. The officer's testimony viewed as a whole indicates that when he noticed the knife upon approaching defendant and retrieved it from defendant's pocket, the officer's intent was to inquire about the assault in order to verify that defendant was indeed the man who had assaulted the victim. Further, it was not until after the officer had retrieved the knife and confirmed that it was a gravity knife that he asked about the assault. In Gaddis-Kelly on page 297, the Second Department determined defendant's motion to suppress credit cards taken from his wallet after he was placed under arrest after a traffic stop should have been granted. We dealt with this case a little earlier. The defendant was arrested after a police officer saw what looked like marijuana in a plastic bag on the floor of the car. Defendant was charged with possessing forged credit cards. The court wrote, while the police officer's search of defendant's pockets was justified since it arose from a search incident to lawful arrest, the subsequent search of defendant's wallet was akin to searching a small bag or change purse and was unlawful. The protections embodied in Article 1, Section 12 of the New York State Constitution serve to shield citizens from warrantless intrusions on their privacy interests, including their personal effects. Even a bag within the immediate control or grabbable area of a suspect at the time of his or her arrest may not be subjected to a warrantless search incident to the arrest, unless the circumstances leading to the arrest support a reasonable belief that the suspect may gain possession of a weapon or be able to destroy evidence located in the bag. The proof adduced at the suppression hearing failed to establish the presence of such circumstances. In Hackett, on pages 297 and 298, the Fourth Department determined the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in Riley v. California did not provide grounds for defendant's second and untimely motion to suppress evidence seized from a search of his cell phone pursuant to a warrant. Before applying for the warrant at the time of arrest, a police officer sent a text to a phone number used in communications between the victim and defendant and noted that a text message arrived on defendant's phone shortly thereafter. The Fourth Department held that sending the text and observing the arrival of a text did not violate Riley. The court wrote, although Riley prohibits warrantless searches of cell phones incident to a defendant's arrest, Riley does not prohibit officers from sending text messages to a defendant, making observations of a defendant's cell phone, or even manipulating the phone to some extent upon a defendant's arrest. Indeed, Riley provides that the search incident to arrest exception to the warrant requirement entitles law enforcement officers to examine the physical aspects of the phone after it has been seized. Next topic is the body cavity search. In Holton, on page 299, the Third Department, reversing county court, determined that prison personnel violated defendants' Fourth Amendment rights in the manner a body cavity search was conducted. A packet of cocaine was removed from defendants' buttocks area during a strip search. Apparently, the package could be seen, but did not fall out on its own. Considering that defendant was lying face down, naked, handcuffed, it is evident that the officers could keep him under full surveillance without any concern that the wrapped drugs would be absorbed into his body while efforts were made to procure a warrant. Nor was any attempt made to seek the assistance of medical personnel to secure the contraband in a safe, hygienic manner. Also, the record is unclear as to whether the officer was wearing gloves. Next topic is cell phones. We just discussed the Hackett case on page 300, where it was acknowledged by the Fourth Department that warrants are now necessary to search cell phones. But in the Hackett case, it was deemed not to constitute an illegal search when the police sent a text message to the defendant's phone and observed the text message arriving on the phone. Again, in the words of the Fourth Department, although Riley prohibits warrantless searches of cell phones incident to a defendant's arrest, Riley does not prohibit officers from sending text messages to a defendant, making observations of a defendant's cell phone, or even manipulating the phone to some extent upon a defendant's arrest. The next topic is cell site location. Two Fourth Department cases, Taylor on page 301 and Giles on pages 301 and 302, had held that no warrant was required to search cell site location information. But the U.S. Supreme Court has determined that a warrant is necessary to search cell site location information. That happened, I believe, in July of 2018 in the Carpenter case. So the two cases that are summarized on pages 301 and 302, Taylor and Giles, are apparently overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court. In a third Fourth Department case, the Lively case on page 302, the Fourth Department recognized that Carpenter overruled their prior determinations, but they held in that case that exigent circumstances justified the search of the cell site records, that there no warrant had been applied for in that case. And the defendant was arguing that he had been deprived of effective assistance of counsel because his attorney failed to move to suppress the cell site location information. And the Fourth Department held that that did not constitute ineffective assistance because the motion would probably have been denied on exigent circumstances grounds. In the words of the Fourth Department, with respect to the merits of defendants' contentions, the Supreme Court recently held that an individual maintains a legitimate expectation of privacy in the record of his physical movements as captured through cell site location information, and that is Carpenter versus United States, 138 Supreme Court 2206, July of 2018. The Fourth Department went on to say, again, finding that the defendant was not deprived of effective assistance, even assuming arguendo that the holding in Carpenter applies with equal force to the contents of text messages sent to and received by the phone, we nevertheless conclude that there is little or no chance that the motion to suppress the historical cell site location information or text messages, if timely made, would have been successful. The Supreme Court recognized that case-specific exceptions may support a warrantless search of an individual's cell site records under certain circumstances. One well-recognized exception applies when the exigencies of the situation make the needs of law enforcement so compelling that a warrantless search is objectively reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. Such exigencies include the need to protect individuals who are threatened with imminent harm. Next topic is consent to search. In Freeman, on page 304, the Court of Appeals determined the evidence did not support the conclusion that defendant consented to the entry and search of his home. The motion to suppress should have been granted. The decision does not discuss the facts and indicates the reasoning of the appellate division dissent was followed. In the words of the dissent from the Fourth Department, the evidence establishes that from the outset, the encounter between defendant and the officer included highly intrusive police conduct, the coercive effect of which could not have abated when defendant consented to the entry and search of his room. Within 2 minutes of the officer's approach of defendant, based upon a minor vehicle and traffic law violation, he was frisked, handcuffed, arrested, and placed in the back seat of a locked patrol vehicle. While defendant was thus confined, the officer asked defendant whether he would agree to accompany him into defendant's residence, suggesting that he intended to enter regardless of whether defendant granted or withheld his consent. The next topic is an arrest by a customs agent. In Page, on page 306, the Fourth Department determined the vehicle stop could not be justified on the ground that the stop was made by a peace officer and also could not be justified on the ground the stop was a citizen's arrest. Therefore, the motion to suppress the firearm found in the car was properly granted. The vehicle stop was made by an agent with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Air and Marine Operations after the agent became concerned about the driver's dangerous operation. The agent called the Buffalo Police Department and pulled the car over using his truck's emergency lights. A police officer arrived and the officer and the agent approached the car together. The court wrote, in concluding that the agent unlawfully stopped the vehicle, the motion court determined that the agent had the powers of a peace officer, but that the traffic stop could not be justified on that basis because the agent was not acting pursuant to his special duties or within his geographical area of employment. The court also determined that the traffic stop could not be justified as a valid citizen's arrest because the agent, who had the powers of a peace officer, activated the emergency lights and approached the stopped vehicle with the Buffalo Police Department officer and therefore acted under color of law and with the accoutrements of official authority rather than as a private citizen. A private person, however, is not authorized to display such emergency lights from his or her private vehicle. Moreover, a private person may not falsely express by words or actions that he or she is acting with approval or authority of a public agency or department with the intent to induce another to submit to such pretended official authority or to otherwise cause another to act in reliance upon that pretense. Thus, the agent was not lawfully acting merely as a private person effectuating a citizen's arrest when he activated emergency lights that were affixed to his truck by virtue of his position in law enforcement. Even a violation of the citizen's arrest statute is not necessarily a violation of a constitutional right. We conclude that adherence to the requirements of the statute implicates the constitutional right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. By precluding a person who acted under color of law and with all the accoutrements of official authority from justifying an unlawful search or seizure as a citizen's arrest, and that suppression is warranted where, as here, the purported private person is cloaked with official authority and acts with the participation and knowledge of the police in furtherance of a law enforcement objective. Next topic is the Department of Motor Vehicles database search, vehicle license plates, in Bushy on page 308. The Court of Appeals determined that a police officer's observation of a license plate and running the registration number through the Department of Motor Vehicles database is not a search. Here the officer did not observe any violation that warranted stopping defendant's car. When the officer ran the plate number, he learned defendant's registration had been suspended due to unpaid parking tickets. The stop was for that reason alone. The officer ultimately arrested the defendant for driving while intoxicated. Expectation of privacy. In McCullum, on page 311, the court, in a matter of first impression, determined the defendant did not have standing to move to suppress firearms found in his bedroom in an apartment. Defendant had been living with the family who leased the apartment. Based on failure to pay rent, the marshal changed the locks, leaving the possessions inside, thereby tendering legal possession of the apartment to the landlord. Answering a complaint of trespass, police officers entered the apartment and found one of the family members who had been renting it inside. The police searched the apartment and seized several handguns in defendant's room. The defendant argued that the people did not demonstrate the eviction had been done legally, and therefore he had standing to move to suppress. But the second apartment noted that defendant, who had relied on the evidence presented by the people, did not demonstrate the eviction was illegal and therefore did not meet his burden of proof on that issue. The defendant also argued that he had an expectation of privacy in the bedroom at the time it was searched, but the second apartment determined once the legal possession was accomplished, defendant had no right to enter the apartment and therefore had no expectation of privacy in his former bedroom. In Vinson, on page 312, the court, reversing Supreme Court, determined that defendant had an expectation of privacy in a single-use bathroom in an adult bookstore. His suppression motion should not have been denied on the ground the police entry into the bathroom was not a search. The court wrote, "We conclude that once he closed the door, defendant had a reasonable expectation of privacy while using the small, single-use restroom, because at that point he was entitled to assume that while inside he will not be viewed by others. The closed door of the restroom was comparable to closed bathroom stalls in public restrooms where a reasonable expectation of privacy exists. This expectation of privacy was not negated by the facts that the restroom was located in a commercial establishment and was unlocked." The inevitable discovery doctrine. In Jacquez, on page 314, the court determined evidence discovered as a result of defendant's suppressed statement was admissible under the inevitable discovery doctrine. The court wrote, "While the record demonstrates that they were discovered as a result of a statement that was suppressed, they were nevertheless admissible pursuant to the doctrine of inevitable discovery. Because defendant would have been subjected to several thorough searches following his arrest, there was a very high degree of probability that normal police procedures would inevitably have led to the discovery of the drugs, even without the statement." In Clanton, on pages 314 and 315, the court determined defendant's statements should have been suppressed because he was in custody, not warned of his Miranda rights, and was asked questions designed to elicit an incriminating response. However, although the statement he had a firearm should have been suppressed, the firearm would have been discovered even if the statement had not been made. Therefore, the firearm need not be suppressed. The court wrote, "We conclude that there was a very high probability that the officers would have discovered the firearm, which was found inside the right leg of defendant's pants during a lawful and routine search of defendant's person prior to his attempted flight." In Hill on page 315, the court determined that the illegal search of defendant's belongings at the hospital did not taint the subsequent search of an area near defendant's residence, which turned up a gun. Defendant, although charged with robbery, was convicted only of criminal possession of a weapon. The victim had been robbed by a masked man who fired a gun in the elevator where the robbery took place. Because the police could not find evidence a shot was fired in the elevator, they believed the robber may have shot himself. The police found the defendant at the hospital, suffering from a gunshot wound in his leg. Defendant's belongings were searched at the hospital, and items taken in the robbery were seized. The police spoke with the defendant and his girlfriend and eventually searched the apartment where defendant lived with his uncle, with the uncle's consent. The majority held that the investigation would have continued even if the illegal search at the hospital had not been conducted. The next topic, inventory search. In Bakui on page 316, the court reversed defendant's firearm convictions because the inventory search of defendant's car was not demonstrated to have been validly executed. The court wrote, "No testimony was given at the suppression hearing about the content of any New York City Police Department policy regarding the conduct of inventory searches or the officer's compliance with it. In the absence of any evidence satisfying the people's burden of establishing the lawfulness of the search of the defendant's automobile, the Supreme Court should have granted that branch of defendant's motion which sought suppression of the handgun found during the search." In Lee on pages 316 and 317, the Court of Appeals determined the people had demonstrated the search of defendant's car was a valid inventory search, despite the expectation contraband would be found. The court wrote, "The people met their burden of establishing that the inventory search was in accordance with procedure and resulted in a meaningful inventory list, and that the primary objectives of the search were to preserve the property located inside the vehicle and to protect police from a claim of lost property. The fact that the officers knew that contraband might be recovered does not invalidate the entire search. The inventory here, while not a model, was sufficient to meet the constitutional minimum." In Sullivan, on page 317, the court, reversing defendant's conviction and dismissing the indictment, determined the police officer did not have the authority to reach inside defendant's pocket and the people did not demonstrate the defendant's vehicle was searched pursuant to a valid inventory search. The court wrote, "We agree with defendant that the court erred in refusing to suppress the physical evidence found inside the uninspected vehicle, inasmuch as the people failed to establish that the purported inventory search was valid. Even if we were to conclude that the uninspected vehicle could be impounded and subjected to an inventory search, a questionable proposition at best, the people failed to establish the existence of any departmental policy concerning inventory searches, or that the officer properly conducted the search in compliance with established and standardized procedures." In Kita, or Kaita, on pages 317 and 318, the First Department determined the seizure of credit cards from under the hood of defendant's car was not the result of an illegal search. The police had validly impounded the car and were following a procedure which required that the car be disabled to thwart theft. The final issue is searches of parolees' property. In McMillan, on page 319, the Court of Appeals determined the warrantless search of a parolee's empty car and seizure of a firearm by police officers was lawful. Defendant parolee argued only a parole officer, not a police officer, could conduct a lawful search. The Court of Appeals held that a parolee's reduced expectation of privacy applied irrespective of whether a parole or a police officer conducted the search.